You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, we celebrate US Independence Day, the 4th of July, and ask where the nation might be headed in future.
For my very first Independence Day celebration as president, there is no place I'd rather be than with you.
My guests, Kathleen Burke and Oscar Guardiola-Rivera, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including why Angela Merkel's political party are making their own feelings known about their relationship with America. We'll also be scrutinising a survey suggesting that Latin America needs to refresh its creative sector, and learning why Brazil is rethinking its approach to gender for those looking forward to a night on the tiles. That's all ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Oscar Guardiola-Rivera, Reader in Law at Birkbeck University of London. Welcome both to the programme. I wonder whether some star-spangled banter could be the order of the day.
It'll serve you right if I sing it.
Indulge you. Hey, feel free.
Soaring eagle.
Feel free
of a certain Attorney General.
To break into song, Kathy, that will be actively encouraged before the end of the programme. A timely discussion. It's a holiday in the US. Independence Day, of course, on July the 4th. 1776, the country's founding fathers signed the Declaration of Independence, beginning the modern-day story of the nation. But where does it stand today? Well, let's ask one of its great exports. Kathy Burke is with us. Before we get into the current complexities, Kathy, tell us a little bit about what we're missing or what you're missing back home. What actually happens on Independence Day?
Well, for most of it's a family holiday. I even looked to see if there was any great football games that people could do, but as far as I can tell, there aren't. So that's the difference from some of the other holidays. The thing is that in the olden days, it was the first century, it was a huge celebration. People gathered, brought picnics, and listened to two-hour orations. Oh, sadly, we've lost that. But what one does now, mostly, is you get together with the family, perhaps the extended family, you have a barbecue, chicken possibly, or hamburgers. There'll be Jell-O salad with bananas in it. My grandmother would make a chocolate cake with chocolate icing. Oh, God. And you would have, essentially, an all-American meal. There'd be masses of beer or wine or whatever. And then, of course, the great thing for us, you'd have sparklers and fireworks. It was a family holiday. You didn't go marching down to the front of the city hall and sing, you know, Rule Columbia or Star Spangled Banner. Now, I think it's probably also in places like the Midwest, those who are celebrating the current administration, I'm sure, are getting together for great banquets, potato salad everywhere, and celebrating the new direction America is going in. Whereas on the East and West Coast, and I'm a West Coast person, is probably a bit more depressed.
And Oscar, I guess that's the key point. If not a nation divided in absolute terms, there surely will be many more people for whom these questions about where patriotism begins and ends and nationalism begins and ends has never seemed more relevant, because you have somebody like Donald Trump in the White House. Do you think his very presence there colors a day like this differently?
Oh, absolutely. And to prove that, and you call for banter, let me quote Russell Brand, who tweeted this today. America, well done on escaping the tyrannical regime of an unaccountable despot. Happy Independence Day. Sure, I mean, if Independence Day is to be celebrated at all, it would be to remind us all of how important it is, self-determination and independence, very different from nationalism, precisely at the time when so many of our politicians here in Britain, for instance, are calling for a renewal of military intervention elsewhere.
Remember that one of the great slogans, as it were, has always been, my country, right or wrong, that your fundamental loyalties are to the nation and not necessarily to any particular administration or even what they do. Now, we today, most people find that a bit difficult. And I don't mean because of Trump. I mean just, you know, after the Vietnam War, and which was really the crux. And that, if you think about it, that's really where the white working class really made itself known. They backed Nixon because they backed My Country Right or Wrong, and they were giving the commies what they deserved in Vietnam. So if you look back, actually, here's the historian speaking, I think perhaps you can trot a little back a bit further than Trump.
Oh, absolutely. Even back to Jackson, a lot of people are saying that Trump might be a Jacksonian.
A lot of time in between 1830s and...
exactly.
But I take your point.
They say history repeats itself.
But it's interesting, because a lot of people are having this conversation, I guess, more starkly now about, you know, Americans are proud flag wavers. They salute the flag, they honor it. And, you know, does having Trump in the White House make certain American citizens think twice about that? But, and on that point, though, Kathy, about that you raised, that this historical perspective, have there always been a group of American citizens who were less comfortable with whatever you want to call it, jingoism, flag waving? Has that been ever present, or certainly for what, 150 years or so?
Has what been flag waving been persistent,
or people who were more uneasy about it?
Oh yes, I mean
as the way it goes from looking from outside.
I think we can't forget the populist movement, the end of the 19th century, which is really farmers and labor up against what they saw as the, you know, the railway barons and the bankers and so forth, against the elites, as we would now, and in a Congress that was quite amazingly corrupt. We think there's difficulty now. People ought to wander back to the Gilded Age, as it was called. But people who weren't farmer labor, they saw this as being almost being encouraged by radicals from Europe. And so, yes, there's periodically these sorts of things. It's a big country. And there can be all sorts of parties and feelings in areas of the country that don't even touch the rest. What's interesting on this one, as on that one, because it did touch Washington, is everyone else has had to take notice.
Oscar, let me ask you about what it means to be an American yourself. Not in that camp, but do you think that the fact that we have Trump and that there are more people asking these kind of questions now will challenge the prevailing view, certainly around the world, even on throughout the Americas, of what being an American actually means today?
Well, of course, being Latin American myself, the first thing one has to say when people reduces America to the United States is that America is also quite big, and not necessarily, you know, it doesn't end at the Rio Grande. But in answer to your question is that, of course, you know, being a U.S. citizen right now means precisely, as we heard, remembering that it is a big country, that its politics have never been monolithic. One goes back to the era of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his vice president, who was, you know, Henry Wallace, who was very close to becoming president. And there one can see where people like Bernie Sanders and Senator Warren and others come from. So perhaps we do not despair so much about current realities.
If one just remembers, I keep saying this every 3 months on Midori House, I think, that from San Francisco to New York is London to Damascus. And so the idea of trying to have one single feeling or approach to things is just dumb.
Well, is it also dumb, Kathy? And we were alluding to this actually just before the program started. If to ask an American like yourself, who's long been resident without the U.S.,
who is indeed an Anglo-American,
what it means to be an American, because that's another critical divide, isn't it? And we tend to have, understandably, a more internationalist, a more engaged approach, or I don't know, is that a generalization of those that Americans that we find who are working overseas and maybe working overseas for the State Department or in their course of their business?
Well, they can't but help but be more international, or they wouldn't have left Missouri. I mean, I'm a British citizen as well, so it depends on which country I go, which passport I use. So I don't have quite the same visceral feeling. But when I first came over to this country, when I was a student, it hurt my stomach if someone said nasty things about America. There's no doubt that there's again, I think I've said in this program before, I can remember when I was 8 years old, out in the front of our farm, thinking God knows why, I'm really lucky to be an American, those poor other people. So it's something that is almost in the soil of the United States, probably amongst other things, because it was the first new nation, it was the first created nation, and the Americans are aware of this, which meant that it was against everyone else. So America, right or wrong.
And are they still the luckiest citizens in the world?
I think if you were going to ask most people, yes, because they're free. I mean, we can think of all the things, the mortality rates and so forth, but nevertheless, the fundamental thing is it doesn't matter, we're free to choose.
And yet it is also very important to remember that sometimes these celebrations, symbolic though they are, sometimes make us forget about the fact that certain things that we believe would never happen can happen. So, of course, one must remember here the title of that wonderful novel, It Can't Happen Here, and how, you know, and here we are discussing Mr. Trump.
Well, let's thank God for term limits.
Exactly. Let's stay focused on the US next, but get a different perspective from that of Germany. German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservatives unveiled their election manifesto yesterday, entitled For a Germany in Which We Live Well and Happily. But keen-eyed observers have spotted a shift in tone. 4 years ago, the programme of the CDU party referred to the US as Germany's most important friend outside of Europe. This year, the US has been relabeled Germany's most important partner. Is that a relabeling, a rewording, or is the omission of the word friend signalling something a bit bigger? Oscar, is it a semantic point, or do you think that is important?
Sometimes we read too much into what people say or write, but in this case we can speculate, and this is a speculation, no doubt about it, that there is the ground is shifting. Although, of course, the dominance of the United States vis-a-vis Europe's foreign policy will not go away, it is absolutely clear and understandable that people in Germany and or France may be doing the risk assessment and thinking, ooh, what if the current orientation in the United States goes on for two presidential periods? Shouldn't we perhaps begin to think about defending ourselves? Shouldn't perhaps we begin to think about a different approach? But again, I say this with caution because we may be reading too much into what maybe, after all, just an electoral ruse.
That's what I'd say. In fact, she's not appealing to the Americans right now. She's appealing to the voters. And they were all quite disgusted with what Trump was saying. So therefore, it's quite foolish. Partner, all right, they're partners, that's fine. They don't have to be friends, at least not until after September.
Well, I just wondered on that point, I mean, how cagey do politicians overseas and their advisors, et cetera, need to be about even how they refer to the US, far less, you know, should Theresa May have held his hand in the White House Rose Garden and so on. You know, the US is taking on not pariah status at all, but it's a friend to be handled delicately in some quarters. How wary, Cathy, do you think other world leaders need to be? Are they overcautious when it comes to their dealings with Trump?
Shall we ask the Australian Prime Minister?
Or Mr. Erdogan?
Well, the thing is, I think, you know, if you think about it over the long term, it's not such a bad thing. There's no doubt that an awful lot of countries took America for granted. They could do whatever they wanted, but the Americans would actually come in and do what was necessary when push came to shove. I don't think it's such a bad thing that a lot of countries have to consider what happens if we're not supported by the United States. What happens if we have to worry more about China? Now, that's a problem, and that's the alternative. That's the alternative. So I think, in a sense, as Trump grows up...
Oh, is that going to happen?
It is bit by bit by bit.
Him a while.
Yeah, well, all right. It's only 5 months. The man only knows about running a small family company, which licenses his name out, and that's about it.
A lifetime.
Yeah, but the point is that there's a great deal of ruin in the country, Adam Smith, one of my heroes, said. You know, and there's an awful lot of Americans. And remember that you know, the majority did, although he's trying to say no, vote for his opponent. I think that if we're going to be particularly realistic about this, when push comes to shove, I don't think anything is going to happen that will endanger the Western world. But think about it. Is it such a bad thing if Trump says, well, let's get out of Syria. Let this be Russia's Afghanistan, for example, tied up there for 10, 15, 20 years. They can't do something. They can't do other things. If you think about it carefully, I'm not sure that that's what he planned, but that may well be the effect, in which case we might look back and say, gosh, how very clever the man was.
Indeed. I think actually Afghanistan was Russia's Afghanistan, but that's a whole other conversation too.
Well,
what about if we look at it from Frau Merkel's point of view, Oscar? She's obviously got more pressing things on her mind, not the least of which, as Kathy correctly said, the election itself in September. Bigger picture, though, even in foreign policy terms, it's closer to home than it's relevant for her, is it not? The Franco-German alliance, looking at the future of the European project. I mean, it's more than a preoccupation. That's everything, isn't it, in terms of foreign policy for Merkel, at least in the short term?
It is an existential preoccupation because to many, and I don't mean just radical analysts, but politicians, the EU is unraveling. Of course, that is the priority. In relation to what was said about the U.S., it may not be a coincidence that the same day this story came out, President Macron was heard saying that they would be prepared to support the U.S. Military action in Syria if necessary. Mm-hmm. So, you see things balancing out, as they say. But of course, there are more pressing matters. Brexit, unresolvable economic situation in Southern Europe, but also the fact that we may be witnessing a huge political shift in very many parts of Europe. It is no longer the case that you would see, left-wing parties and a lot of anger being channeled in that way in Southern Europe. Of course, there's Spain, there's Portugal, there is Greece. But now it's also happening in Northern Europe, here in Britain, of course. And that, I'm sure, vis-a-vis electoral challenges, is something that they must be Frau Merkel must be looking at quite closely.
She's going to get a bit tired, I suspect, of trying to deal with Louis XIV Mark II, though. The idea that, striding along between his soldiers down the Hall of Mirrors. It's not such a bad thing to have viable oppositions, I don't think. In fact,
I think it's a good thing.
Indeed, and France doesn't have one right now. But it probably won't be too long. Well, a couple of years. And the thing is that there are, that's more of a problem, isn't it? It's fragmented. But in Germany, it's not going to be, I cannot think that people are going to want the CDU to be in power yet another time. In fact, and these things change. These things changed. But I do. I look forward to watching Merkel and Macron together sometimes.
Indeed. Well, we'll keep a weather eye on that. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, Kathleen Burke, Oscar Guardiola-Rivera. Coming up next, we'll be looking for bright sparks from Latin America. Oscar, more bright sparks, I should say. Do stay tuned.
Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better, from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
You You're tuned in to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Kathleen Burke and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. A recent survey from the UN's World Intellectual Property Organization, in conjunction with European and US academics, the Global Innovation Index, has highlighted concerns about the creative health of Latin America. Now, all surveys should be approached perhaps with a healthy degree of skepticism. Just ask the pollsters pre-Brexit or pre-Trump. But the survey suggests the whole of Latin America and the Caribbean applied to the World Intellectual Property Organization for around 1,400 patents last year. This is compared to one nation, for example, South Korea, that applied for closer to 16,000. Are Latin American countries, I don't know, held back by too many regulations and maybe not enough investment stifling creativity? Oscar, what do you make of this?
Well, you called for a high degree of skepticism. Let me insist on that. One should be very skeptical about surveys such as this one for many reasons. Technically speaking, to begin with, it reduces what is, you know, innovation in knowledge and creativity to a matter of property. Secondly, and here let me speak as a lawyer, it also reduces a matter of intellectual property to a matter of patents. That's a serious mistake. But even if you were to accept that framework, what you see here, actually, what this shows is the long-term consequences of the brain drain. There's plenty of innovation out there coming from Latin Americans, but one of the effects of globalization, of an uneven globalization, and what in the 1970s they would call an uneven global economy, and even a combined global economy or dependent economy, is the fact that many of those who would be more creative and so on travel up north. And they do so precisely because the economy has not allowed these countries to grow their own technological hubs, and instead it has cornered them into becoming, as it has happened with Latin America in the last decade and a half, extractivist hubs. You know, when that happens, I mean, you don't have to be a radical economist to know that if the emphasis in your economy is on oil, gas, and minerals, and so on, you're not going to reinvest that in creating creativity.
So when does that process get challenged? Because you have countries like Brazil, like Argentina, like Mexico, which are amongst the world's biggest, if you take the world's biggest 25, 30 economies. Can they not arrest that drain by investment in R&D and investment back into innovation? Or is it something, is it a more fundamental, I don't know, almost a structural problem that can't be addressed by one or even two governments?
Well, what I'm arguing is that it is a structural problem. Having said that, if you compare these results with the results that a country such as Brazil was obtaining not long ago, you see that the results were much better. And even today, you see examples in countries such as Bolivia or Ecuador of very interesting upward trajectories precisely in this respect. So the point here is that this is not just an economical problem. It is also a political question. And part of the problem with Latin America is that it has been ruled for the most part by terrible leaders, by, elitist, families who treat their countries as if they were their summer houses. And of course, they do and are very have no interest in developing these other sources of creativity, which in fact they might see as politically dangerous.
Kathy, as much a political as an economic problem?
Well, I was thinking about this. My husband is, in fact, an intellectual property lawyer. So occasionally over dinner, believe it or not, we discuss these sorts of things. If we're talking about patents and trademarks, that is property. That has nothing to do in that sense with creativity, which has is other sorts of things. So if we're looking at the results of that survey, and if we're comparing it to South Korea, South Korea pays a lot of money on education. And South Koreans think education is extremely important. So in my, one could say that, yes, structural, what it isn't is the fact that you aren't educating the people to do this. It's back to the universities as much as anything. And so in that sense, political, if you don't want to pay for the university, but there are a lot of universities in Brazil, and there are a lot of universities in Argentina and so forth, and they could do it if it was seen as important. So I think you can't always blame the lure of North America. I mean, obviously, you can individually because you go where the money is and you go where the, you know, where you can do what you want. But India, which did that for years, is now the Indians are going back because there are possibilities at home that there weren't before. So in that sense, I think, I mean, I agree with Oscar in the sense of structural. It's just we have probably slightly different terms, because if the people are there, the companies will come.
Well, an idea about sort of following the money, Oscar, I mean, from a purely... from a pure position of self-interest, presumably also highlighted was an absence of, say, venture capital investment, this sort of thing. I mean, that would be there, would it not, if the money was there? I mean, venture capitalists wouldn't allow a political stance to get in the way of good economics in terms of their own investments, right?
You know, venture capitalists are not a condition of possibility for high investment in education. Actually, our arguments were not rather than contradicting,
they
support each other.
Yeah.
Precisely because you have had governments who are not prepared to invest in education. I'm not just talking about higher education, plenty of universities, but that's another conversation about universities in our places. But even at the basic level, if your governments are not interested in making that investment because they think that a more thinking people is politically dangerous, which you know it is, and all the best for that, then you have these problems. Of course, in South Korea, you see these results because there has been investment in education. You don't see that in Latin America precisely because we have had the governments we have had. You see how these changes when governments change and do invest in their people. I mean, this is no magic. There is no magic here. What there needs to be is a political will, and of course, as for examples of people going back, again, you see Ecuadorians going back from Spain to Ecuador precisely because something interesting is going on there.
And also, just in a word, to playfully paraphrase the title of your own book, could this happen, I don't know, in our lifetimes? Could we see Latin America ruling the world?
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah, absolutely. In many ways. I mean, we spoke about the change of fortune for Southern European political parties. Where do they learn their lessons? And actually, this is the other side of my answer to your question. They learned their lessons in Latin America. There are things that cannot be patented. There are innovations which don't go into this service. Latin America has been a hub of political invention in the last decade and a half like no other.
We only have a minute left, but I can't possibly let either of you leave without getting a view on this final story from Brazil. The country's common practice of allowing women into nightclubs for free while charging men is under threat. Fairly logically, Brazil's now saying the policy enforced by venues is unbalanced and they will combat it using legislation if necessary. Kathy, in a word or two, why do nightclubs in Brazil treat men and women differently, and is it right that they do?
I believe always in equal rights for both. So if men want to come and pay ridiculous amounts of money to watch women, I think they should have every opportunity.
Which is a slightly, yeah, that's it. Nicely avoided my question. Oscar, what do you make about this? Is this a progressive move? Is it actually papering over broader cracks?
Oh, it is progressive. Let me be a Latin American self-critical person. Actually, women are used as bait in Brazil and many countries in Latin America, particularly in these circumstances. But this is part of a wider story, which involves, for instance, President Temer of Brazil on Women's Day saying that women were just happier shopping at the mall and their place is the kitchen. So there is something much more interesting about this story.
There's a way to go yet.
I think that may be the understatement of the day so far, Kathy and Oscar. Thank you both very much for being with us on Midori House. That is the end of today's programme. Thanks to Kathleen Burke and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Thanks to our producer, Tom Hall, our research team, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maya Higard, and our studio manager, Kieran Banerjee. More music next, Section D at 1900. We'll have more on the big stories of the day on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Andrew Muller in the chair for that one. This is Midori House. It'll be back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.